Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1182, I will have a couple of segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. During the second segment, I will air the remarks of U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen and Senator Jeff Merkley speaking about their newly released report titled "The Netanyahu Government is Implementing a Plan to Ethnically Cleanse Gaza of Palestinians. America is Complicit. The World Must Stop It." The situation in occupied Palestine continues to worsen every single second, with apartheid Israel's execution of its plans to kill as many Palestinians as possible and ethnically cleanse the remaining Palestinians from Palestine. Apartheid Israel's terror, destruction, atrocities, and war crimes go beyond occupied Palestine and the destroyed Gaza Strip as it continues its terror campaign in several countries in the Middle East, bombing Syria, bombing Yemen, bombing Lebanon, bombing Iran, attacking the flotilla in Tunisia, and most recently, bombing the state of Qatar. Who knows what it will attack next, but that's what happens when you kill, murder, and destroy with full impunity. You just keep at it until someone stops you. But it does not seem that anyone wants to stop apartheid Israel. Yes, there are lots of condemnations, but that's it. Just condemnations. Words. And they seem to make no difference whatsoever. Let's listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 706 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has killed at least 500 Palestinians and injured nearly 2,300 between September 3rd and September 10th, according to official records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza. On Wednesday, September 10th, at least 72 Palestinians were killed since dawn, including 53 in Gaza City alone. Israel has put the entirety of Gaza City under a forced displacement order as it bombs high-rise apartment and office towers, homes, and shelters, vaporizing dozens of buildings, one city block after another, with no end in sight. Our contributor Asim Anabih, the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality, posted this photo of one of the leaflets the Israelis dropped over Gaza City on September 8th. He writes that, quote, "As the sun rises, Israel drops leaflets on us, demanding that we leave Gaza City. I contemplate the leaflet and its poor language. I contemplate the details of the faces of my fellow workers and engineers, still preparing their equipment to begin work. I go out to the gate of the heavy machinery garage and contemplate the heavy footsteps of the people and their emaciated bodies. I return to my office, burdened with sadness and grief for Gaza, its people, and myself. I sit on a chair worn by war, dust, and worries, browsing the news and photos of my beloved, thousands of miles away. All that comes to my mind is that death is very close, closer than ever, and God is the source of help." Since Friday, September 5th, at least 7 high-rise towers have been obliterated by constant Israeli airstrikes. The Mushtaha Tower was destroyed on September 5th. Journalist Wissam Shabat filmed this clip, showing the moment Israeli warplanes targeted the high-rise. The Al-Susi high-rise residential building was struck on September 6th. Instagram user Yazan Racha filmed this clip. " On September 7th, the Al Roya commercial building was destroyed. Journalist Ahmed Ibrahim captured the explosion on camera. The 12-floor building housed the headquarters of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, along with media offices, medical clinics, sports facilities, and other civilian offices and companies. PCHR said that their office on the top floor had been bombarded and extensively damaged since the start of the ongoing genocide. It was also raided by the Israeli army and used as a military base during its previous operations in Gaza City, rendering their offices inoperable. Their two other offices in Khan Yunis and Jabalia were completely destroyed last year, the group added. The Israeli army hit As-Salam Tower at night on September 8th. Journalist Faiz Kureka shot this video of the moment the building exploded. Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's civil defense, stated on September 8th that the five buildings that had been destroyed until that point contained more than 200 apartments, with at least 20 people per unit, leaving more than 4,100 residents homeless in one night. Surrounding the towers, he says, were more than 350 tents, each sheltering families of around 10 people, which were also destroyed, displacing another 3,500. In total, more than 550 families, some 7,600 people, have been stripped of shelter and basic necessities, forced into tragic and unbearable conditions. We continue to call on the world, he says, to take action to protect innocent people here in Gaza before it is too late. More massive apartment blocks were destroyed on September 9th, and on September 10th, Israel hit the Taiba Towers in western Gaza City. Instagram user Mohammed Hamouda filmed this clip. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated that the airstrike killed approximately 15 displaced Palestinians who had sought safety in and around the building. Civil defense worker Mohammed Komsan described the overwhelming terror of displaced families as Israel's wanton destruction of Gaza City has escalated.
Hello everyone. Today in Gaza we're facing all kinds of forced displacement, not just a house or two. The occupation bombs massive residential towers that once sheltered hundreds of families. In seconds, their dreams and memories are gone. And when a tower collapses, one big question remains. Where are all these families supposed to go? Where is their in a safe place left? Every day, the space around us gets smaller. The occupation advances, pushing us tighter between the sea, the tanks, and the rubble. Displacement isn't just losing walls of your home. It's a deep psychological wound. Can stand fear, and anxiety, a scene of loss, and sometimes even feel like a stranger among your own people. This is our reality today, a reality where people are stripped of the simplest right, the right to have a place to sleep.
Mohammed Komsan of the Civil Defense in Gaza. The strike on the Al Roya commercial building on September 7th happened just days after the United States officially sanctioned the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, along with Al-Haq and Al-Mizan, the leading human rights organizations working on international criminal accountability for perpetrators of atrocity crimes in Palestine. In a joint statement on September 5th, the human rights groups said that, quote, threatened by the impact and role of our advocacy, legal research, and documentation in exposing Israel's ongoing international crimes, the United States has resorted to punishing individuals and organizations seeking to uphold the legal system upon which the international community was founded. The implications go beyond Palestine. By protecting Israel from accountability, they are dismantling the international legal order and undermining the possibility of justice for victims of grave crimes anywhere. Israel also targeted a facility for people with disabilities in central Gaza City on September 7th. Journalist Ahmed Kahil captured the strike.
Okay.
Cahil also documented Israel's attack on the Thauba Mosque that same day in the Al Daraj neighborhood. He says that right after the attack on the mosque, the area was targeted a second time while he was filming. Quote, just now the place was bombed again, a totally random bombing, he says. A man on the street tells Cahil that the Israeli army called people and said they will strike again and told them to evacuate this area as they are about to bomb it.
الآن قيام جيش الاحتلال باستهداف مسجد الثوبة في حي الدرج. هذا هو مشهد الدمار الذي حدث في المنطقة. الآن تم استهداف المكان مرة أخرى ونحن في المنطقة متواجدون.
That was from journalist Ahmed Cahil on September 7th. Palestinians in Gaza City say they are not leaving their city on Israel's orders. Journalist Nahed Hajjaj captured this clip of a man standing on a pile of rubble on September 10th, saying, quote, the army is striking high-rise buildings to force people to go south. I'm not leaving. If Netanyahu destroys everything, I'm not leaving. I will clean this up and live here once again. I'm not leaving. Even if I have to die here, I am not leaving. Palestinians led a demonstration in Gaza City against Israel's genocidal displacement orders. Dr. Munir Al-Bersh, the director general of the Ministry of Health in Gaza, stated, quote, in a historic scene, community leaders, families, healthcare teams, and all the people of Gaza gathered in one of the largest demonstrations, carrying Palestinian flags and symbolic shrouds to declare a unified stance. Displacement from Gaza only towards the sky. Gaza tells the world, we will not leave except as martyrs. Here we were born and here we remain. Meanwhile, a BBC investigation found that U.S. mercenary forces working security at the joint American-Israeli private Gaza Humanitarian Foundation killing sites masquerading as aid distribution points include members of a motorcycle gang with an extremist right-wing white Christian nationalist ideology. At least 10 members of the Infidels Motorcycle Club, who are working in Gaza for UG Solutions, a private contractor providing security at the GHF sites, have been identified by the British broadcaster, which revealed that 7 members of the gang are in senior security positions in Gaza. Quote, Infidels MC was set up by U.S. military veterans of the Iraq War in 2006, and members see themselves as modern crusaders, using the crusader cross as their symbol, a reference to the medieval Christians who fought Muslims for control of Jerusalem, the BBC says. The gang is currently hosting anti-Muslim hate speech on its Facebook page and has previously held a pig roast in defiance of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The gang's leader, Johnny Taz Mulford, is a former sergeant in the U.S. Army who was punished for conspiracy to commit bribery, theft, and making false statements to military authorities. He is now the country team leader running UG Solutions contract in Gaza. UG Solutions is paying each contractor nearly $1,000 per day, including expenses, rising to about $1,600 per day for team leaders at GHF's so-called safe distribution sites, documents seen by the BBC show. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have killed nearly 2,500 Palestinians and injured more than 17,000 at so-called aid sites since the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation began its operations in late May, according to the Ministry of Health in Gaza. Children and adults alike are continuing to die of starvation across Gaza. The health ministry said that 5 deaths from starvation were reported between Tuesday and Wednesday, including a child, bringing the total recorded number of deaths from malnutrition to 404, including 141 children. The mother of 18-month-old Ali Abdul Nasser Abu Adra, who is hospitalized with extreme malnutrition at Nasser Medical Complex, says that her baby's weight has dropped to just 3 kilograms. He should weigh at least 10, and he is suffering from chronic diarrhea and dehydration. Journalist Mohammed Ashraf Salama captured this clip of the mother and her baby Ali earlier this week. She says that her son is so fragile that medical staff haven't been able to insert an intravenous cannula into his body for the past 10 days, and that he is in desperate need of treatments that are not available due to Israel's ongoing blockade. She adds that a referral for medical evacuation was issued 9 months ago and was renewed last month, but the World Health Organization has not contacted her yet, nor have they provided her with any assistance. Malnourished patients at Nasser Medical Complex are dying, she warns. Quote, there is no treatment and no nutrition. Israel is continuing to attack and bomb medical facilities in Gaza. On September 7th, Israeli quadcopter drones attacked the Association for Women and Child Protection, a maternity care facility, killing a child and a pregnant woman seeking services and injuring several Palestinians. A man was also killed. His own child found him in pieces. The man, identified as Ahmed Ashour Al-Ghul, was a staff member at the facility. He had asked his young son, Laith, to fetch his phone charger from his office nearby. As the boy walked back with the charger in hand, the Israeli drone bombed the entrance to the clinic, with Laith finding his father's body and head torn to pieces in front of him, according to Al-Ghul's cousin, the novelist and activist Yusri Al-Ghul. Journalist Mahmoud Abu Salama reported from the scene following the drone strike. Along with showing several people killed and wounded, his camera captures Laith staring at his father's body. Abu Salama says that another Israeli airstrike has just happened near the hospital. Quote, here is a violent Israeli airstrike targeting this place. A number of martyrs, as you can see. This is the scene, he says.
عدد من الشهداء والمصابين كما تشاهدون في هذه الغارة الإسرائيلية هنا في هذا المكان هذه غارة أخرى أيضا بجوار المستشفى كما تشاهدون طائرة لاستهداف في جوار مستشفى الوفا هنا غارة إسرائيلية عنيفة استهدفت هذا المكان عددا من الشهداء كما تشاهدون هذا هو المشهد هذا هو المشهد لمنتظري الشهداء هذا هو
Turning quickly to the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers stormed Masafer Yatta near Al-Khalil on September 5th, stabbing and assaulting the villagers of Khalat al-Daba. Sahat News Agency reported that at least 13 Palestinians were wounded, including a three-month-old baby, two elders, and women and children. On September 10th, armed settlers attacked the homes and properties of Palestinians south of Al-Khalil, according to Wafa News Agency. A local resident said that settlers used tractors and drones to terrorize people and their livestock in the area. He added that settlers have been playing loud music at night in an attempt to instill fear among the local children. Israeli soldiers have been raiding towns and villages northwest of Jerusalem for days, following a suspected resistance operation by Palestinians earlier this week at the Ramot Junction in occupied East Jerusalem, which killed 6 people and wounded 12. Local sources told Wafa News Agency on Wednesday that Israeli forces stormed the town of Biddu amidst confrontations and fired live ammunition, tear gas, and sound bombs at Palestinians. They raided and searched several homes. The sources added that Israel launched a large-scale raid on homes in the towns of Katna and Al-Kubayba, assaulting people, ransacking and searching their contents, and turning a home into a military barracks. They detained and interrogated citizens on the spot. Al Jazeera reported on September 9th that during the intensified raids, Israeli forces destroyed 3 other homes of Palestinian resistance operatives and a detainee accused of an earlier attack as punishment. Soldiers encircled the house of detainee Thabet Masalma, accused of having carried out a shooting in December in the town of Beit Awa, southwest of Hebron, before blowing up the property with explosives. The raid sparked clashes with locals, during which Israeli soldiers fired live ammunition, wounding 2 people. Masalma is accused of taking part in an attack that killed an Israeli settler and wounded 3 people. The demolition left the detainee's wife, parents, and 3 children homeless in the town of Aqaba, north of Tubas. Israeli forces also demolished the homes of 2 prominent local leaders of the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, who had been killed in Israeli operations, Al Jazeera reported. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight There Is Nowhere Left to Go, We Are Trapped, by Malek Hijazi, writing from Gaza City. Malek writes, quote, "Before the announcement of a ceasefire in January 2025, I was among the 400,000 people who stayed in northern Gaza. The experience was overwhelming and unbearably hard. Israel did everything possible to force us southward. We endured severe bombardment, chessboard-like displacement, and famine for more than a year. But my family and I refused to leave. We knew the occupation could not force us to abandon the places where we were born, raised, and lived most of our lives. And we knew that if we left northern Gaza, the occupation would take over our land. The morning of September 9th, after a night of relentless shelling that shook both the walls and our nerves, I woke to the news that the Israeli army had ordered 900,000 people in Gaza City to move southward to what they call a humanitarian zone. The warning came shortly after Netanyahu declared, quote, in the past 2 days, 50 of these towers have fallen. The Air Force brought them down. Now all of this is just an introduction, just a prelude to the main intense operation, a ground maneuver of our forces who are now organizing and gathering in Gaza City. On the maps, the entire area was marked in red, a color that now signifies danger and death. Netanyahu calls these attacks a prelude, while for us, life has been a continuous hell. The Israeli F-16s and helicopters are intensifying their bombing of the city while quadcopter drones hover above. Sometimes they drop leaflets with evacuation orders. Other times they release small bombs directly over our heads and homes. They have broadcast insults that I have personally heard, calling us cows and dogs, or shout, stay tuned, we will invade Gaza City soon. In recent days, Israel has destroyed several prominent buildings in Gaza, including Al-Susi and Al-Roya Towers, landmarks that once anchored neighborhoods and gave the city a sense of structure, identity, and even a hint of modernity. The families who had lived in them were suddenly homeless. These buildings had also been surrounded by dozens of tents, families living in their shadow after losing their homes. When the towers fell, the rubble crushed the spaces where the tents had been, and the displaced were displaced again, their shelters rendered uninhabitable. This is not a battle. Each armored vehicle carries enough explosive to obliterate everything within 100 meters, including homes, streets, and all that lies between. The tanks roam the streets like mechanized predators, forcing entire neighborhoods to flee in panic. My family and I have searched desperately for an apartment farther south in the strip. Khan Yunis and Rafah have already been pulverized, reduced to ruins. We cannot survive winter in a tent. We have called every number, begged friends, searched endlessly. There is nowhere left in Gaza to absorb us. Many people will not leave, not because they want to risk their lives, but because of the numb indifference that follows witnessing genocide. Death has become, for many, the easier and more affordable option. For us, there is no longer even the illusion of choice. The walls are closing in, and we ask not only where we can go, but whether there will be any place left at all." Those are excerpts from There Is Nowhere Left to Go, We Are Trapped, by Malek Hijazi, a writer in Gaza, on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza. Ahmed Muin Abu Amcha, a music teacher and someone we frequently feature in this section, documented his own perilous forced displacement this past week. But in setting up his tent shelter near the beach, he found a new parachute to protect the kids from the sun, which he said he will put above the tents and the activity spaces he and his colleagues have established for music classes. He captioned this clip, quote, "We played with it under the strong wind. It was pulling us, and the children's laughter filled the air. Later, we set it up as a safe shade above the tents. Even though preparing the new space took so much time and effort, we do our best to create a place of joy and hope for the children.
Hello, everyone. Today, we have a parachute. I'm going to put it above my tents and for the activity to cover the kids from the sun.
And Instagram user Mohamed Abu Kamar, who regularly posts videos singing with friends and children on the beach, sang a song for the Gaza-bound International Flotilla, which is aiming to break the siege on Gaza with dozens of boats this week. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland and U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon traveled recently to Israel, the West Bank, the border of Gaza, Jordan, and Egypt on a fact-finding mission to better understand the various forces shaping the ongoing humanitarian disaster in Gaza and to press for an immediate ceasefire and the return of the hostages. On September 11, 2025, both Senator Chris Van Hollen and Senator Jeff Merkley held a press conference to release a new report they have compiled detailing their findings on the humanitarian situation in Gaza following their recent fact-finding trip. And their conclusion was detailed in a report titled, "The Netanyahu Government is Implementing a Plan to Ethnically Cleanse Gaza of Palestinians. America is complicit. The world must stop it." I'm going to air now most of the remarks delivered at that press conference, followed by some of the questions and answers.
From our trip, from our observations, from our firsthand accounts, it's clear that the Netanyahu government has gone far beyond targeting Hamas to imposing collective punishment on all the people of Gaza. The title of our report is "The Netanyahu Government is Implementing a Plan to Ethnically Cleanse Gaza of Palestinians. America is Complicit. The World Must Stop It." The Netanyahu government has not kept its goals secret. And we start in this report by quoting members of the Netanyahu government, including Prime Minister Netanyahu himself, who has said that one of their war aims is the removal of the Palestinian population from Gaza. I urge all of you to read those quotes, because what now they're doing and what we witnessed is putting those goals into action in Gaza. We visited the Egyptian Gaza border, and Senator Merkley and I had been there back in January 2024. And at that time, on the Gazan side of the border was the thriving Palestinian town of Rafah. This time, when we went to that border, we were able to climb up a taller building and actually look directly into Gaza. And what we saw with respect to Rafah was rubble. And you can see from this photo that Senator Merkley took that you could see it with your naked eye. And when you got your binoculars, you could see the city of Rafah, which had been home to about 210,000 people, Palestinians, reduced to rubble. We also met with some very courageous souls, people with true moral courage, people who had served in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and served in Gaza, who told us that they had been part of this systematic destruction of civilian infrastructure. Our report goes into some of the figures, but just for example, 90% of the homes in Gaza have been destroyed or severely damaged. And in our interviews and through our observations, it was clear that the Netanyahu government is also restricting the delivery of humanitarian assistance into Gaza, including using food as a weapon of war. I'm going to briefly summarize some of our findings. I urge you to look at the details in the report with respect to restricting food getting into Gaza. And then Senator Merkley will talk about the challenges of getting that food distributed within Gaza to people who are starving there as we speak. If you look at our table of contents, and we've just passed out the report to many of you, we break the restrictions on food in the Gaza into a number of parts. I'm just going to read them and not go into great detail, but I think it's important to understand the level of specifics in this report. We start with the 78-day total blockade of food and humanitarian assistance to Gaza that ran from March 2nd to May 19th. And as a result of that, you had a huge amount of people starving to death in Gaza. One of the things we heard loud and clear is in order to address that problem right now is to open more crossings in to Gaza. There are two that are regularly open, Kerem Shalom, which we visited, and Zakim. There are two others that the international organizations have pushed to have open as regular crossings, not sporadic crossings, in order to get more food into Gaza. That has not happened yet. There are, in addition, the advent of this so-called Gaza Humanitarian Initiative. Senator Merkley will speak more to this. This is when, after that total siege on food, the blockade on food, instead of reopening the normal UN delivery system, they moved toward this system with private contractors, private security folks, opened just four sites for 2 million people, three of them in southern Gaza, none of them in the north, clearly designed to use food as a method of population control as they try to push the Palestinian population out of northern Gaza. And of course, we're witnessing right now the military operation there. We also point out deliberate obstacles at the Israeli port of Ashdod, the deluge, the just mountain of unnecessary requirements and red tape that slow down the delivery of food into Gaza, the failure to protect convoys along what's called the Jordan Corridor. There are a couple major corridors for getting food in. One is through Jordan, and we go through in great detail all the restrictions put on getting food in through that corridor. Another, of course, is the Egyptian corridor through Rafah, and that goes through Kerem Shalom. Huge restrictions there as well. No clear list of banned and dual-use items. So, for example, when we spoke to the Jordanians, they said you can never predict what would be denied entry. And they had just learned, for example, that peanut butter and honey and dates could no longer be part of a convoy. And when a truck is turned around for one item that is restricted, they have to turn the whole truck around. And you'll see a great amount in this report about the detail of the huge amount of very deliberate red tape intended to restrict the flow of humanitarian aid and food. I will just highlight one example. It was one of our early stops at the port of Ashdod. This is a port, Israeli port, north of Gaza. And it's the sort of receiving point for the World Food Program of food that's offloaded to be distributed to Gaza. They told us very clearly that because of unnecessary restrictions that have been recently imposed since the end of the blockade, 2,200 shipping containers worth of food were being unnecessarily blocked right there. Enough food to feed everyone in Gaza for 3 weeks. That is just one example, but it's part of the larger theme that we heard throughout about deliberate obstacles placed in the way of getting food to people in Gaza. I'll end with this. The Netanyahu government is now, you know, talking about how their plan is the, quote, voluntary removal, transfer of Palestinians out of Gaza. If you read this report and you look at what's happening on the ground, you recognize how cruelly cynical that phrase is. There is nothing voluntary about wanting to depart when your home is gone, when your agricultural fields are no longer accessible and no longer arable, when your schools are gone, when all your cultural facilities are gone, when the city of Rafah is reduced to rubble. And so we, the United States, are complicit in all of this because we're providing lots of taxpayer dollar support to the Netanyahu government to use weapons in Gaza, 2,000 bombs and other weapons. We have said that that must stop given what's happening right now in Gaza. We were critical of the Biden administration for not doing enough, and now the Trump administration is providing the Netanyahu government with a blank check of American taxpayer dollars to fund and support the horrible things that are happening right now in Gaza. The world must end this, and we will do everything in our power to make that happen. And now let me turn it over to a good friend and colleague and somebody who is determined both to shine a spotlight on what's happening, but determined also to end the war and bring the hostages home. Our very last meeting in our very first public meeting, I should say, in Israel is with the hostage families, many of them. We met in Hostages Square in Tel Aviv. Their message to us was clear, that Netanyahu has prioritized his political survival over the survival of our loved ones. We believe that to be true. We need to end the war. The United States needs to do its part to end this war now and to bring the hostages home now. Senator Merkley.
Thank you very much, Chris. And no one in the Senate has spent so much time and effort to be fully educated about the dynamics in Gaza, the West Bank, in Israel, in Jordan, in Egypt. So thank you so much for your leadership. I want to emphasize that this strategy of ethnic cleansing in Gaza has these two main components. One component is to destroy homes so that they cannot be returned to. Despite having seen the city reduced to rubble through satellite photos, to stand, to climb an outside staircase, fire escape to the top of a three-story building, stand on a ledge, look over and see this city reduced to rubble, that was extraordinarily powerful to just bear witness to that strategy that's being implemented. Not long ago, as Chris said, 1 million people were here, many of them refugees from other parts of Gaza. That second strategy deprived Palestinians of essentials to live, food, water, medicine, and the piece of this that receives the most attention is the food factor. And Chris has described obstacles about getting food into Gaza. But even after you get it into Gaza, getting it to the people most in need is extremely challenging. If you think about what we were told in our first trip by international organizations, they said, look, if food gets to a certain low level where families are starving, groups will start to raid the trucks before they get to the warehouses. They'll break into the warehouses and raid those. Then they'll start raiding the trucks en route to the warehouse, because that's what you see everywhere in the world when people are starving. Well, that's exactly what we see in Gaza. But now think about the fact that those who are in most trouble in terms of nutrition are those who are the weakest, and that is the children, that is the disabled, that is the seniors, that is the mothers who are pregnant, the mothers who have recently given birth. But to get food to those populations, you have to be able to have an organized system through the warehouses. There is a special supplement for starving children. In much of the world, it goes by the brand name Plumpy Nut. But other companies produce it and call it things like nutritional supplement. A truck full of nutritional supplement, if it is raided en route to a warehouse, that nutritional supplement doesn't get to the children who need it. So what we learned from the international groups is they said the way that you solve this is you flood Gaza with food. And we saw this happen during the ceasefire. We had suddenly 600 trucks a day moving food into Gaza. And when people knew that they were going to be able to access food, they didn't need to raid the trucks, and then you were able to start reestablishing the supply of food to those who need it most. So under this strategy in which food is deliberately restricted by the Netanyahu government, we're going to continue to see children, women, elderly, disabled, starving. And this is the heart of the famine that is there right now. The second thing I want to emphasize is we have a few chapters in the course of this year. We have the chapter of the ceasefire from January 19th to early March, March 1st. Then we have this full blockade from March 2nd through May 19th that produced a hugely accentuated level of starvation. And then we have the third chapter in which Israel, in response to the world, said, yes, we're getting food in, and we have this great system, this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF strategy. And as Chris described, that strategy was to open four sites, not the hundreds of sites that existed through the United Nations distribution system, but four sites. Think about that, four sites to cover 2 million people, with three of the four deliberately located just in one corner in the south. The goal of that was, hey, if you're in Gaza City, somewhere to the north, the only place we're going to get food to you is if you go to the south. This is part of that strategy of displacement. That strategy has not worked well. According to a report by a humanitarian group, they recorded 1,373 people killed from May 22nd to July 31st, the bulk of those happening in the vicinity of those four distribution sites. Another group called this not aid, but orchestrated killing. Who would ever come up with an idea to replace hundreds of sites where people can access it to four sites in the south? Think about whether or not a mother who's already malnourished is going to be able to walk miles to one of those sites, maybe carrying a child, and somehow lift a 40-pound box and make it miles home. I mean, clearly, this was a strategy that was not meeting the moment in any possible way, but a continuation of a strategy of food deprivation. Ethnic cleansing through destroying homes, ethnic cleansing through deprivation of food, water, and medicine. And now we have Gaza City. Gaza City is en route to looking like this. Rubble. Just as there were 1 million people gathered in Rafah, the regular population plus folks who had fled from elsewhere in Gaza, and now it's rubble, there are 1 million people in Gaza City. And in a few months, it may look like this. What does that mean if we look down the lane. While it means 2 million people clustered in tents, without a food distribution system, without a clean water system, without a sanitary system, without a power system, without a communication system, without a roof over their head, with the goal of pushing people out of Gaza. And the United States is engaged in conversations to help find places where people might be shipped to. The United States has to quit being complicit in this ethnic cleansing, has to quit being complicit in this war crime.
Thanks, Jeff. We're happy to take any questions that you have. Yes.
Thank you, Senators. Eric Martin with Bloomberg News. I wanted to ask you about your conversations with the Trump administration or your recommendations to the administration as to where U.S. policy should go from here, what leverage the U.S. should be putting on the Israeli government, the Netanyahu government, or what the U.S. Request and urging should be to the government at this point in terms of its policy towards Gaza City and towards Gaza overall?
Sure. As you saw, our conclusion is not only that the Netanyahu government is committing ethnic cleansing in Gaza, but the United States is complicit. We're complicit because we have effectively given the Netanyahu government a blank check. No restrictions, no red lines. And the Trump administration has therefore facilitated this. We were both critical of the previous administration for not doing enough. So the United States has the kind of leverage as a partner to be able to use our influence to end this war and bring the hostages home. I mean, after all, on the campaign trail, Donald Trump said on day one he was going to end the war in Gaza. He hasn't come close. And the reason he hasn't come close is he has refused to put the kind of pressure and use our leverage with respect to the Netanyahu government that we can do it. And if you talk to the, you know, if you talk to hostage families, and I think recent polling in Israel indicates this is the view of the majority of the people of Israel, that Netanyahu government and Netanyahu essentially prioritized his own political survival over the survival of the hostages and the end of the war. Yes.
And Stephen Gross with AP. I'm wondering, from the Senate and, you know, acknowledging that you're in the minority, what can be done? Are you expected to have any resolution votes or anything of that sort? Just following up on this.
Sure. Well, both of us are members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and both of us are members of the Senate Appropriations Committee. And in both those committees, there are opportunities to put things to a vote and make sure that people are on the record. In the Senate Foreign Ops Committee, of the Appropriations Committee, that is where a lot of the funding is to support military assistance to Israel and to the Netanyahu government. That's also where the administration is, we suspect, would get the funding to support something like the GHF. So we will be looking at opportunities there to hold the Netanyahu government accountable and try to get desperately needed humanitarian assistance and food to people in Gaza.
It is significant that in the last two votes we had on arms sales in the U.S. Senate, 27 senators said we shouldn't be providing rifles. Those rifles are used both in Gaza and on the West Bank. The West Bank is an additional story in which there is now a green light for settlers to hugely attack Palestinian villages in a systematic way, cutting them off from olive orchards, from vineyards, from springs, from wells. Our report today is about Gaza, but to have half of the Democratic caucus vote more than half, vote against an arms sale. You would not have expected that 2 years ago. I've been throughout my life a passionate supporter for Israel, believing in the vision of a homeland for the Jewish people, believing that they had hostile neighbors, and wanting to do everything I can to help strengthen them. But the same values that made me a champion for Israel compel me to say what they are doing to the Palestinians, both in West Bank and in Gaza, is absolutely wrong. And I do hope we can press internationally for two states, for two people. I still believe it's the best way for peace and prosperity for both Israelis and Palestinians.
Yes.
Patricia Zingerly from Reuters. Do you think that incidents in the U.S. reaction, like the attack on Doha yesterday or the day before, will have any influence? I mean, there were reports that, and the president said that he was unhappy about it. Do you think that that will have any influence on the attitude toward helping Gaza, or are the two things just separate?
It's hard to read the minds of the Trump administration. We've been following their statements on the attacks that took place in Doha. It does make clear, and should make clear to the Trump administration, if they didn't already realize it, that the Netanyahu government is not interested in a negotiated settlement that brings the hostages home and ends the war. I mean, it's been pretty clear from the beginning that, you know, Netanyahu is a servant to the most far-right extreme elements in his coalition, who have threatened to leave his government if he was to end the war in Gaza at this point. So I hope that the Trump administration wakes up. Netanyahu has played Donald Trump beautifully through all of this. I hope that some of the more recent actions they've taken are a wake-up call.
If I could have the confidence of Trump, if I thought he would listen to me, I would say draw a red line right now on Gaza City. Tell Israel, we're not going to provide economic aid. We're not going to provide weapons, offensive weapons. If you continue this assault, the hostage families are clear that if a campaign taken many months goes forward on Gaza City, there's a very high chance that their loved ones who are still alive will not be alive by the end of it. Good chance that they're being held in Gaza City. Good chance that they won't live a few more months, being moved repeatedly just as those who are with them are moving to escape bombs. And use that power to create a permanent ceasefire now. It's a ceasefire that enables the hostages to get home. It's a ceasefire that stops the massive deaths of women and children. It is a ceasefire that allows in humanitarian aid and therefore the ability to stop the famine. It is a ceasefire that allows negotiations towards a better future.
I want to just say amen to everything that Jeff Merkley just said. If you think back a number of years, the Biden administration actually drew what it described as a red line with respect to Rafah. He said that if the IDF went into Rafah, you know, too fast and just destroyed it, it would create a humanitarian disaster. Well, Rafah's been reduced to rubble. We need to establish very clearly, as Senator Merkley said, that continuing the demolishment and attacks on Gaza City are unacceptable. And then we need to back it up. We need to back it up by using U.S. influence in the way that we've said, to do what Donald Trump said he was going to do on day one, end the war and bring the hostages home. I do just want to say, with respect to the West Bank, and we have a little bit in this report on the West Bank, it is not the focus of the report, but both of us, you know, have been there in prior years, And you can see the changes rapidly taking place in terms of more illegal settlements, trailers on the top of hills, Palestinians being pushed off of their lands. And in this report, we do describe what's happening on the West Bank as ethnic cleansing in slow motion. The bottom line is that the United States needs to play its leadership role in the world with a country that has been our longtime partner, as Senator Merkley indicated. And a partnership has to be a two-way street. It's not like a one-way road. And the United States has interests in bringing an end to this horrible conflict and bringing the hostages home. We have strategic interests. We have moral interests as a country that says we stand up for human rights around the world. And so really, this is the time to use that influence to end the war and bring the hostages home. So thank you all very much for being here. And we urge everybody to read the report. There's a lot of detail in here that we were not able to cover in the time we have. Thank you.
What you just heard were the remarks by U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland and U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley from Oregon, followed by questions and answers delivered at a press conference they held on September 11, 2025, revealing their new report titled, "The Netanyahu Government is Implementing a Plan to Ethnically Cleanse Gaza of Palestinians. America is Complicit. The World Must Stop It." I have a link to the full report on our website, arabvoices.net. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.